I'm Christian Scheller. Welcome to my podcast, an enthusiastic ramble through whatever has taken my interest the past week or so. Expect technology, games, history, travel, geekery, and as always, much, much more. Hello, everybody. I am back from KubeCon. Well, actually, I've been back from KubeCon for a week. It always takes me a little bit of time to get everything together because there's always so much to go through. And this year, being probably the biggest KubeCon EU ever, definitely the biggest in the past 3 years, there's been a lot to go through, back to the pre-2020 levels. 10,000 people on site, 5,000 people online, which is obviously something new. And with 58% of attendees KubeCon first timers, I think this might indicate that just the interest levels have grown over the past couple of years when there wasn't really a KubeCon to go to or when people didn't want to go to, that kind of thing. But that was very interesting to see. And continuing into the CNCF statistics, it now has over 800 members, 1,300 maintainers, 200,000 contributors, just a shade under 160 projects, and 12.2 million contributions now. I will quickly cover some of the trends, but I'm going to direct you to look at the Substack post and Medium post I publish on the topic, because there's only so much I can go to in the podcast, and I want to focus the podcast on the interviews I did. And there's quite a few. This is going to be a long episode as it is, so I will touch on them lightly. And if you want to get more info, more links, more context on all of these, go and read the post that you can find in the notes. So first was security. And this is specifically software supply chain security, in addition to the traditional security like access control and things like that. Lots and lots of vendors talking about this. And I not only have more information in the post I mentioned, but I have a separate post that I've been working on covering all of them because there were so many. This is a big topic. And the CNCF was following its own best practices to get audits and assessments of some of their most popular projects. And you can find links to the results of those. And it's also included fuzzing, which is a little different, but just shows that the CNCF acknowledges that these are now big concerns and that they should, just as anyone using these tools should be assessed, that the tools should also be assessed, which is good to see. Continuing another theme from last year was sustainability, the carbon impact of containers and cloud native specifically. And this was talked about a lot last year, but this year I think emerged more cohesive cross-vendor tools for people to use in more friendly, user-friendly ways to get an idea of the carbon impact of everything they're using. And again, to find out some of those projects, take a look at the post. Now we'll come to artificial intelligence. This is obviously something that's been very, very lively in the past few months and wasn't explicitly there so much at KubeCon. I did see a few cloud GPT powered blah, 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 and a few vendors sort of mentioned it's something they're also working on. But we have to bear in mind that cloud native technologies are actually powering a lot of these AI tools, Kubeflow, things like that. Also, I did speak, it wasn't recorded, with some people from Canonical, and we also talked about confidential computing, confidential containers, confidential information in machine learning payloads, basically. So the ability to learn, to have these large models without having data that is personally identifiable to people. And that was something I saw a few bits on, but it's largely pushed with Kubeflow and Canonical. And I've spoken to Kubeflow people before on the show. That aside, there was an interesting discussion in the media briefing around the topic where the CNCF didn't really have a stance on it yet, But there was kind of a meta conversation that came back to that with a lot of open source code feeding these models, could there also be similar to the software supply chain security tools that could almost analyze code running in containers and other infrastructure to say, this came out of a generated tool, this is feeding a generated tool, that kind of thing. So we could leverage some of the similar technologies to look for different things, not security, but sort of functionality, even copyright, even not to say ownership because it's open source, but the origin of code running. I don't know how simple that would even be, but it was an interesting discussion nonetheless. Okay, so very, very quick few minutes there, just recapping some of the general things. One last time, go and take a look at the Medium post or the Substack post where I'll dig into more information on all of those topics. Now I'm going to dive into four interviews. The show will be reasonably long. The first is with Slim AI, who fit now. I think last time I covered them on my video stream. They were specifically mostly around container slimming, and now they have a vulnerability tracing tool as well with the intention of hardening containers at the end of that. So getting rid of the things you don't need to make the containers as lean and mean, if you like, as they can be. So first interview is with Slim AI. Second interview, another repeat visitor, is with Min.io, talking about their S3 compatible object storage for cloud native and some interesting developments from them. Then I spoke with incident.io about their human side to incident management, not just the this thing went wrong, but more the who deals with it, what's the workload on those people, and that kind of thing. So the what's next after you've actually detected there's a problem. And then finally, I talk with HiveMQ, whatever you want to call it, specifically aimed at edge and IoT devices. So kind of light and fast and efficient. And those are the four interviews. Strap yourself in. There's going to be a few, and I'll talk to you on the other side. What is Slim AI?
Oh, that's a very good question. So Slim AI is all about how to harden containers and improve the security of containers, right? And you do that by first being able to scan your container images for vulnerabilities, just to understand what is going on in your containers, right? We need to know what's the file layer structures, what are the packages looking like, what are the vulnerabilities looking like, and also the risk level of each of the vulnerabilities. From there, we can go on to harden our containers. And when you do that, you are actually removing packages that are unnecessary for you to be able to run your containers and actually have them function fully. So when you do that, you reduce the image sizes, and that makes it more efficient. And then there's also actually removing the vulnerabilities, which makes it more secure. And we know that there are a lot of vulnerabilities out there that that can impact the security level and make it easy for potential attackers to be able to infiltrate the things that people are pushing out to production. So that is what Slim AI is all about, is minimizing or reducing the chances of that actually happening by optimizing container images.
I think I have a memory that when I looked, whenever it was mostly focused on the reducing size, and I guess the name indicates that. Is the vulnerability, security, and features, is that a newer feature, or was it always there and I just forgot about it?
I would say, so I'm a bit newer to the company, but I would say there's been a lot of focus on how can we actually remove vulnerabilities. So I don't know for sure when that became a bigger focus, but I do know for me now, seeing how what engineers are working on and the features that we're focusing on, it is how can we make sure that we are remediating vulnerabilities? And that should be one of the core features of the platform and our command line interface, is able to do that from either your local machine or be able to do that in the UI. And I've been playing around with it since I've been working here, and it's been amazing. amazing to see like the difference between starting off with like a public image, maybe like an Nginx image, and then hardening it and seeing how many vulnerabilities are removed from it and making it more secure to be able to be ready for production if I wanted to use it as a base for an application I want to build.
So I do remember this topic, which is called a bunch of different things, but things like S-bombs come up, so it makes me laugh. It's such a funny sounding acronym.
I know.
Software supply chain security.
I know, so many so many words. It's like a tongue twister.
It was a big topic last year at KubeCon, and I think the Linux Foundation has come up with some kind of standards around it, I think. I sort of lost track of that. And I feel like I've seen a lot of press releases around other companies looking at this year as well. So let's go back to the fundamentals, though. Why does it matter?
Why do S-bombs matter?
Why does any of this, why do I care about my containers? What is the potential risk I have by just putting words in your mouth, pulling random containers?
Yeah, you know, it's when I speak to the chief data scientist of Slim AI, I ask her that very question. It's like, what is the big deal? And she is gung-ho about this idea of hackers are very practical people. And when you are releasing things to the internet through these in production through containers, and they have extreme amount of vulnerabilities, right? You are showing them that there are ways that I can infiltrate and gain access to data that they should not have access to, right? And you're putting people and things at risk. And I think one of the biggest things in cybersecurity in general is that you are on one of the techniques is about being on defense mode, right? And I think that's part of what Slim AI is trying to participate in, but from a different angle, is how can we mitigate or prevent this, the having to even be on defense mode in general by reducing the amount of vulnerabilities. I mean, I think security is one of the most important things on the planet, to be honest. If things aren't secure, like how can we have any type of privacy for our data, for ourselves as human beings? And when we put our trust in engineers and people who are running and creating these companies to secure our information that we're giving to them, that's really important. I know that's important to me. I'm expecting that it's important to other people. So it is our top priority. You know, it's funny because I used to be a software engineer before I became a developer advocate, and I didn't know anything about security. But the more I dive into it as a developer advocate, I see how important it is for developers to understand what DevOps engineers are doing, right? Their whole workflow, it benefits developers to know that when DevOps engineers are empowered because they're doing great things, and their work empowers developers to be able to actually build great things.
Yeah.
Because greatness is more secure.
And I think this is where the initial versions of Slim AI kind of came into the equation, in that now with container, you know, take a typical container, you have, let's say JavaScript's a good example, it's a bad example. You have a container, you have a JavaScript application. Already in there, you have hundreds of dependencies.
Yes.
And with all these developers not really caring about security, who knows what's in there?
Right. You kind of just ship it and you just go with it, right?
Versions kind of showed you insights just into what's in there. Even not having an opinion on it, just like, what is in there? And there's all these things you don't even need that other people have added that you've just added as well. And even ignoring security, its cost, its environmental impact, et cetera. And now, you know, the observability space is also bigger, which covers some of that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a busy space now. What has Slim AI added to what it had before that is what you think unique above some of the other tools that do some other jobs?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think there are a lot of teams or companies out there who are they want to be able to scan their, you know, run vulnerability scans and understand what's inside of their containers. I think we try to take it to the next level. It's like, you're not going to only know what is happening in your containers, what your files and packages look like, and also the risk level of each of the vulnerabilities. It's like, we want to be able to take you through a process of removing those vulnerabilities in a way that is not manual. DevOps engineers, from what I understand, they have a lot of pain points around manual container hardening. And that's the big thing that we want to be able to remove from their experience, to improve their experience, right? Is that SLIM takes care of the automated hardening process for them. So if, you know, it's difficult. If I don't know if you've ever been through this like manual removal of different vulnerabilities, thinking like, okay, I just remove this one package and everything will be fine. And then suddenly everything's breaking because it turns out that it was necessary for another thing. That is the beauty, I think, of SLIM. It's like, we're not just scanning your container images for vulnerabilities. We're saying, okay, now we're going to take you through the process of slimming it so that the vulnerabilities that we understand that we can remove, we will remove it. And that entails injecting SLIM sensors, right, into this temporary container that we create based off of the container image that you are telling us you want to harden, right? And then we want you to run that container so that the SLIM sensors can conduct all of the tests and can get all the information it needs, observe everything that it needs to understand what is everything that is actually needed to run that container. And then that will be able to, you'll be able to differentiate what is needed and what is not needed. That is the information that these sensors need in order to harden. That's how we find out if we don't need these other extra packages, let's get rid of that. And we'll be able to successfully run your container image without those packages. I have been able to harden containers. And so I've tested containers prior to hardening. When I say testing, I mean like Nginx. Like, how do you test Nginx? You can curl, localhost, whatever, whatever, and check that it is running. And then I have hardened a container, and then afterwards I have tested it to make sure, is it still functioning? And it is, as expected. So I think there's a lot of granular, very meticulous things that are happening within the process of implementing the SLIM sensors and also the algorithms behind actually hardening that ensures that it should be able to function the way that you would expect it to.
Some get so deep. I mean, JavaScript, I keep picking up because it's such a good example, and I know it fairly well, is you can have Node packages that require Python and C packages, and you just end up with this ridiculous chain of dependencies you didn't even think you needed.
And I think that when you are describing the pain points that developers, I remember being a software engineer working at an ed tech media tech company that I will not name, but dealing with dependencies as a front end engineer was an absolute pain. You know, you just remove one thing and it's just like, now your whole day is gone.
And even particular versions, you know, this is where we come to what you're saying, is you remove a particular vulnerable version, but if 10 other things were hinged on it,
exactly.
What's worse, breaking the program or being insecure?
And I think that's part of what fascinates me about, like, the engineers that are working on this particular product, is that these are all the things that they're thinking about, right, and that they're trying to solve and are solving. And I don't get impressed by many things, to be honest. Even if I do get impressed, I'm bluff and I'm just like, yeah, it's fine. I'm genuinely impressed by how they're able to handle all of these exact use cases that you're mentioning.
Well, hopefully it's through the help of tools like SLIM AI. But coming to that automation side, I'm assuming the answer is going to be, it depends, and it's up to you, but how automated can it be? Can it literally be, I trust SLIM AI, go wild? Or it can be, I want to approve everything before things are changed and stuff like that?
That's a good question and a difficult one.
Okay.
I'm going to be very honest here. from my experience and from the experience of everyone I know who have utilized it, our design partners, they have a very positive experience with the container hardening process. And I don't think I've heard any complaints about the about what you're mentioning. But automation has a definition.
Yeah.
And there are steps required for a DevOps engineer or developer to interact with our command line interface and or our UI in order to harden containers. So I do want to say that.
Well, like automated assistance and automated fixing.
Right.
And most tools I know, most people would still rather check it first.
But I do, yeah, so it's relative, but that's, it's a good type of relative because it's better than what DevOps engineers are experiencing right now. So I think that is the big thing, is like there is an improvement here in their experience and the ability to ship more secure code.
Yeah.
I think that's the big focus here. And there's also like there's levels and layers to this that of course that this could grow to being truly fully automated in ways where they don't even have to think about this.
Yeah. That'll come with training and trust.
Yes.
And on that subject, this is where it gets very interesting with tools that offer to help you with security, with vulnerabilities, with hardening, etc., etc. There is a degree of trust needed in the product. And so why should people trust in AI?
Why should people trust Loom AI? Well, I think one of the things, outside of the fact that there are incredible people working here, I would say that when it comes to things like the vulnerability scanning, is that we're leveraging multiple scanning tools. And I think that kind of removes some of the bias around the results that we would get from our vulnerability reports. And I think that allows for more accurate results of what is the most important things that you need to be focusing on to get rid of in order to improve and optimize your containers. I would say that that is one of the biggest things, because what that ends up leading to, what smaller image sizes and like the less vulnerabilities, the more secure it is. That's like one of the biggest things I would say that you can think about when it comes to trust, is that we're not just relying on one tool, is that we're looking at all of the tools in order to come to a consensus on what are the biggest types of vulnerabilities and their risk levels that we should be addressing, that we then have the responsibility of addressing through that hardening process. And of course, like with Slim Sensors, we're utilizing incredible like tools here, like OpenTelemetry and, you know, all of these different things that are empowering us to be able to understand
behind the scenes for you to monitor the
Exactly. To be able to understand what in the world is going on when you start up the container, run it, and then stop it. That is the information that we need to understand how to actually harden the container. So we're using incredible tools that we haven't even built ourselves. Of course, we're relying on the tech community who have built amazing things to empower us with our tools. So if you trust OpenTelemetry and other tools out there, then you can that would hopefully help you to trust Slim.
Who watches the watches? Anyway, before we go down that path. So are there any new things you're announcing at KubeCon? Or have announced?
I mean, there's a whole bunch of different features that, I mean, I think there was the SBOM thing that we've been focusing on. Like, we can generate SBOMs, and also you can download the SBOMs. When you run the vulnerability scanning tool, that is automatically generated. And I think that's important for some companies or teams when it comes to security compliance. So that is something that's available to us now. And then also the instrumented container hardening artifacts, you're also able to upload them or download them throughout the hardening process. So there's just a lot more, I guess, data, I would say, that's available to people who are utilizing the platform if they choose to, which is very important in the cybersecurity space, I would say. But it's only good. There's so many more features that are coming up ahead of us.
And let's end with a hard question.
This one's going to be the hardest one. I'm like, every one of these questions was hard. I'm like,
there's increasing competition in this space.
And oh my goodness.
Reasonably big names like Cisco is announcing something. Docker has announced something that have fairly, both those companies have fairly good kind of market exposure. I don't know what the right word is. And in different fields. So how will Slim keep innovating to stay ahead of? Because it's kind of one of the earlier entries, but that doesn't always mean that you're the one people stick with. So how will you remain more relevant?
You know, I think it's part of it. I'm going to be honest. I think part of it is going to depend on what exact features are they offering. There has been a lot of focus on vulnerability scanning. Mm-hmm. There, like we use open source tools for that process, right? Gripe and Trivy and what is it? There's Claire and others. I think that is an admirable thing to focus on. I want to see, are they leveraging or are they implementing this automated hardening process? And how are they going about that? And I would like to know from you if you've seen that that's one of the features that they're emphasizing.
Not yet.
Okay.
But the examples I'm thinking of are all earlier features, so mm-hmm. it doesn't make a point.
But yes, I've certainly seen, I mean, every day, new competition popping up. I see that, and it does, you know, it is a little frightening, right? But then when I dig into it, when I look at the features, when I, you know, start to do my research, I'm like, we do have an edge when it comes to the idea of how can Slim be implemented into this CI/CD pipeline in a way that just like, you know, there's less friction for the whole DevOps workflow. And I think that hardening thing is a really big thing to focus on. Hardening, slimming, whatever you want to call it.
Minayo is an object storage. It's built for scale and speed, right? And we only do one thing. So we don't do file, we don't do block, we only do object storage, right? And we use the S3 API because we think Amazon did a great job of popularizing the object storage API. We're the first ones to launch an object storage API. So we have 100% compatibility with that API, and pretty much every software out there today that's cloud native has support for the S3 API, right? So that means that you can get like a Spark pipeline up and running and point into a Minayo instance, and the Spark won't tell the difference between the S3 API and us. So that's like a summary. So if you want to build your own storage, you can go bare metal, right? So, or you can build on VMs or you can build on containers, and that's why we are KubeCon, right? So we have a large amount of customers who actually are automating all their operations. And because now DevOps and GitOps are extremely popular, they are using our operator for that.
And just to sort of summarize for people who may be newer to the subject, what kinds of things is object storage?
Object storage is it's anything that's data, pretty much, right? But the difference with other types of storage, like block storage and file storage, is that objects are not meant to be mutated. Right, so you push the file, you upload your file to the object store, and then when you need it, you retrieve it. Right, so it's meant to be simple, and it's meant to be consumed over HTTP. Right, so we're not mounting anything locally. Right, so that's the core difference between what file and block storage will be versus object storage.
Okay, and what's new for Minayo in the past year, for example?
Well, in the past year, we introduced a bunch of new features. For example, we enhanced the site replication capabilities of Minayo, right? So now if you're doing on-premise deployment or hybrid cloud deployments and you want them to be in perfect sync, not only from the data perspective, but also users and policies and configurations, we can set up a site replication. This has turned out to be extremely popular with telecoms, right? We also introduced a batch replication framework, which is mainly for when you have a large amount of data, rather than having a client copying the data, you can ask Minayo to push the data to some other location, right? So let's say you just started a new disaster recovery site and you want Minayo to start pushing the data as fast as it can, but of course, prioritizing service. And also in our operator as well, we introduced a new passwordless authentication paradigm for workloads, right? So now you as a DevOps can be like, okay, I need this application to have access to my files, but I don't want to give it any credentials, right? Because if the application gets compromised, those get compromised as well. So now you can just assign Minajo policies to a Kubernetes service account and then give that service account to your workloads, and that will actually allow them to go into your Minajo, right? So it's, that's also one of the new features introduced recently.
What would be the advantages of using Minajo over just more S3 storage?
I mean, if you're an AWS customer, you can run a cheaper petabyte inside AWS. And there's customers, for example, we have this social network customer who is like, okay, it's not the bandwidth cost that are eating me, it's not the storage cost that it's eating me, it's the number of API calls I'm making because I'm running analytics on top of S3, and the cost is just too high. But I have a bunch of EC2 instances running, laying around, so I can deploy Minajo using EBS volumes, and that's actually saving them cost a lot, right? So you can run, right? We also have financial institutions inside AWS, right? But of course, if you are outside of AWS, and that's where Minajo wants to be the S3 API for everyone outside of AWS, like on-premise, you have a bunch of servers, you want to build like a massive multi-petabyte setup.
So to understand correctly, I think you're not actually writing to S3.
Yeah.
You are replicating the
API
of S3 to let people use it, but like it's somewhere else.
Exactly.
Right.
So, and you can get started even in your own laptop, right? So you could download it and run it. And there's people running Minajo inside a camera, on a car. Medical devices are running it locally. You can run it on the edge. So it's quite versatile because we're entirely software-defined. We're not going to tell you, go buy this appliance or go buy this hardware. We work with whatever hardware you see fit to acquire. Or if you're in a cloud provider, right? Let's say you're moving from AWS to Azure and you want to bring the S3 API with you because all your pipelines already work on that. You don't have to change them, right? Just deploy Minajo on top of Azure, and that's it. You're still in business. And for people that are working on-premise, it's even greater, right? Because on-premise, you can get like a cloud-native interface and start working, and you can do hybrid. That's also very common with our customers.
It's just kind of like a drop-in adapter. You can take your legacy code that uses S3, but instead swap out to Minajo and have flexibility.
I would not use adapter because behind the scenes, it's actually like a full-fledged distributed storage. Right, so you can build a multi-petabyte setup again for very high speeds. And that's because, let's say, you chose to use the latest hard disk drives, NVMe's, right? So, and you can build anything that matches your use case on top of Minajo, right? So that's actually the top feature of Minajo. You can build very large, resilient, distributed software storage. And the API that you use to consume is S3, right?
Okay.
So only we only do one thing again, but we do it very well.
And also makes it... I guess flexibility. So maybe some data can still go to S3.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it needs to go to somewhere else. Some of it goes somewhere cheaper. Some of it goes on prem.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all the same
API. Exactly.
Okay. Cool. And what are you at KubeCon to promote, to talk about?
I mean, we want to engage with our customers that are using our operator. We want to promote it also to other customers because right now we see this shift in the industry where people are leaving other storage, right? Like the HDFS ecosystem is collapsing, right? So all these companies are looking like, what am I going to do now? So it's like, guess what? If you already have our own Hadoop, right, you can just change the schema from HDFS colon to S3A colon, and it will work with S3. So you can just deploy a Minajo data lake, migrate all your data, and we have tools for that. And then once you migrate all the data, right, just change the endpoint for your pipeline, and it will just work like nothing happened.
Yeah.
Right? So that we see where in this KubeCon, we're seeing people that are like, okay, we were not able to move HDFS into Kubernetes because HDFS was not built for Kubernetes. Right? So... we see that use case a lot. And then also to promote our operator, it has the new features that I was telling you about earlier. So that's why we're mainly at KubeCon this year.
Why? I mean, I actually haven't heard much about Hadoop in ages. Why do you think it is collapsing?
Oh, because there's these large enterprises that were supporting, you know, HDFS, and they started to merge because they were having financial trouble, and so slowly they're going out of business.
Is it just the switch to cloud native doesn't suit?
Yes, because I mean, I tried really, really hard to make HDFS and Hadoop run on top of Kubernetes, and I failed miserably, right?
Yeah.
So it's because HDFS has this expectancy that things have like a fixed IP address, which doesn't play nice with Kubernetes, right? So
yeah. Oh, well.
Yeah. So, and I actually know that there's companies that offer like their proprietary, well, not proprietary, their modified HDFS that runs on Kubernetes, but still, you need to go to them only, right?
Yeah. 6 months' time, a year's time, the next KubeCon, what's going to be your announcements that you could talk about?
So, we're working on a variety of products around the object storage because we see, okay, our customers are pretty happy with a stable storage solution. But what else can we do for them, right? So we're coming up, for example, with a security product, right, that will come included with your Min.io license that says, okay, let me analyze how you're actually consuming your object storage and make sure you're not over-provisioning access to your applications. Because sometimes people are like, okay, this application may need access to 10 buckets, but then we can, by observing your usage, we can be like, you know, you only are accessing one bucket, one folder. We should actually remove everything else from your access policy, right? And we can propose that. So that's a product that we're building for our customers, right? So, also saying, okay, you create accounts. This account is never active for the past 6 months. You should probably disable it or remove it, right? Because why have it, right? So this account, you have not rotated the credentials in 6 months. You should probably rotate them, right? Encouraging our customers to have better security practices. And this is supposed to be a hands-off approach, right? Just turn this on and we'll start analyzing the traffic. And then we'll start telling suggestions. Like, you should probably change this. You should probably change that.
What do people... Because Min.io has an open source component, I think. Yeah.
Everything is open source at Min.io.
But you obviously have to make money as well. So
yes.
What's the differences between the open source and the... the hosted, the SaaS, whatever it is?
Well, we don't have a hosted solution, right? So everything is run by our customers, right? And there's no enterprise version, and open source version is just one version, right? It's Min.io, and we're 100% open source. We are open source under AGPL version 3, right? So AGPL is like the truest form of open source, of course. Now, if you're using any type of software that's under the AGPL version 3, you also need to share your software as open, right? Now, you could acquire a Min.io license to be granted an exception to that clause, so you don't have to share your own software, which is how our customers come to us, right? They come and acquire a Min.io license, so they don't have to share their own software. But, of course, it comes with a lot of extra features. When you acquire a license, one of them is support, for example.
Yep.
So that's how we make money.
But also, any of the optimization feature you mentioned, would that be an enterprise-only feature, or is that also...
That comes with the license. The security feature, yes, of course. It will come with the license.
Final question, then. If you've had time to look around, what are some of the things at KubeCon this year that interest you?
You know, I'm very, and this is more of an engineering opinion, but I'm very happy what the Linkerd guys are doing this year, right? So Linkerd, they've been around for a while now, and they keep improving. And every time I meet with them, they have new stuff, and they're keeping things simple. Like, because I tried to go the Istio way before, and I failed miserably. And then I see Linkerd, and they just keep getting better, faster, easier. And they're always open for suggestions. So that's, every time I come to a KubeCon and I see their booth, I like going and see what's up.
So Chris and Stephen from Incident.io, I've seen these t-shirts around as well.
Yes, there's a lot of them here. Yeah.
And I was trying to figure out where they came from. So that's good to know now. What is Incident.io? I have a vague idea from the name, but maybe... In your words, what is it?
Yeah, I can pick this. So we're basically like incident management software, but built for kind of like this century. So I think there's no shortage of people that exist in this space. So you take like PagerDuty, that's like the big incumbent, I think, in the space. And where we sort of fit in is kind of like after PagerDuty. So PagerDuty typically will wake folks up. And then there's this myriad of stuff that happens for folks responding to incidents, having to follow up from incidents, having to communicate with customers, all of that sort of side of things. And that's like our sweet spot there. So sort of very concretely, we sit within Slack currently, so that's the communication tool of choice for our customers. We have like a really solid integration into Slack, which allows them to sort of orchestrate the incident, plug into all their tools, basically just streamlines the whole process. And there's like automation and things that you can use in there as well to make things a lot easier.
There are a few that claim to do what you describe as well. Is it one of these tools that lets you dig into lines of code or infrastructure that might trigger alerts, things like that?
That's a good question. So the answer is no, and sort of very deliberately no. So I think what makes Incident.io special is it is not built as like an engineering tool. It's built as an organization tool. And that is sort of very much grounded in the roots of where it came from. So prior to starting the company, the three of us who founded it were at a company called Monzo in the UK. So like trendy startup bank. And I originally built when I was there, like a sort of pretty simple like Slack bot type thing to help make incidents a bit easier because they were an absolute nightmare. So, you know, a classic one would be like, you'd get reports through customer success that people couldn't make card payments somewhere. And it'd be like, great, well, that's my starting point as an engineer. And now I need to think about regulatory impacts. I need to think about like communicating with MasterCard OCC. And I need to think about like N other different things that go on there. And so that is just an organizational problem. It's like, how do you pull all the different corners of the company together and give them a sort of a common substrate that they can all communicate on, collaborate on in these very sort of high pressure situations.
And also just extracting what you are not. Are you also anything in the kind of observability area? Some of the observability companies now are doing sort of alert based notifications on telemetry data, things like that.
So I would say, yes, we are an observability, but with a sort of like very big, heavy asterisk, which is we are an organizational observability tool rather than a systems observability tool. So
now I'd like to dig into what you mean by that, because we all know that many technical tools don't really solve problems.
Yes.
Usually organizational problems are actually the problems.
Yeah.
So how does incident help with that mushy human stuff?
Yeah.
That's what you mean by
organization. I do, yeah. So I think if you look at like common problems that organizations have, it is things like, you know, can they answer questions like, we're having lots of incidents, but like, where are they happening? Or how much time are we spending reacting to things that are sort of being inflicted on us? So stuff going wrong or, you know, inbound like that versus proactive work that we've put on our roadmap. And because we are sort of this hub of how people are responding to incidents, we have just an absolute like treasure trove of data around that kind of thing. So we know who's communicating when, what the interactions look like. So we can very quickly sort of help you pinpoint, you know, this team here is in, you know, largely reactive firefighting mode. That is something you would otherwise have had to rely on like anecdotal evidence for. Now you've got it sort of empirically put in front of you. And, you know, sort of myriad of other things that you can do in that space. Other things you can do is be like, well, as an organization, how reliant am I on key individuals who, you know, are the sort of ones who swoop in when something goes wrong and they're able to fix all the things? And where we are able to help there is we can say, well, how much of your org has sort of dealt with an incident in the last 30 days, for example?
Okay.
And you can sort of prepare for things.
Now, I think I get what you mean. Observability is not actually the right term. People at KubeCon tend to misuse it.
Yep.
To mean all sorts of things.
Yep.
It's more the managerial metrics on the people handling the incidents.
It is. It's like debugging your org, but it's also passive rather than like, it's not overly invasive. It's like, these are people doing what they kind of need to do their jobs, and you sort of out sort of the exhaust fumes of that process can suddenly start to see things that you weren't able to see before.
So kind of like how I imagine, you know, the sort of various perspective charts and things like Jira, you know, who did the most tickets and which ones took a long time, et cetera, that kind of information.
Yeah, exactly.
Does it sit on top of the actual reporting tools? Do they have to integrate with a reporting tool, or do you do that as well?
Yeah, so I would say sort of the world before people use us is when something goes wrong, they are manually gluing together many different tools. So that might be get paged from PagerDuty, and then I jump into Slack. I create a Slack channel. I then go to Google Meet and start a call there. I update my status page in another tool. We send out an update to our customers in status page. And they're kind of like the glue that is holding a lot of these things together. We are the product that sort of you deal with, and then we will glue all the other tools kind of for you. So you kind of come to us. And as a result, like one of those tools that people end up integrating us with is usually the place where you'll get work done in the organization. So this is your Jira, Linear, GitHubs, like kind of work tracking systems. What those are mostly used for in our product is to, you know, after you have, say, a postmortem or a debrief, people usually end up kind of aggressively agreeing that, like, you know, we should do this thing, we should repair this system, we should spend some time here. And it often goes into the kind of Jira black hole, never to be seen again. And you see this kind of like continual loop of things, you know, kind of reoccurring. That's the sort of place that we want to do is not, we don't want to replace any kind of one tool in your stack. We just want to make them work better together. And as a result, you know, the whole goal is we should sort of meet you where you are organically sort of solving this problem in Slack, which many of our customers are doing, but sort of replace the human glue that has to like pull everything together and kind of give you a much better experience, but without it feeling like you're doing it wrong. Like go and learn this other set of tools and kind of...
Just to clarify, because the one thing you didn't address there was you do get the alerts from somewhere else though?
Yes.
Yeah, so there's...
And which one of the sources?
Yeah, so there's two ways that you can kick off an incident in our product. So the first one is manually. So imagine you're a customer support agent and you're like, this is the third time I've seen someone saying they've not been able to log in the last 5 minutes. You can raise that as an incident. You can sort of raise it as like an issue that you could be triaged. That's like the manual person putting their hand up saying, I think something might be wrong. We then also have what we call kind of triggers. So these would be, you know, systems like PagerDuty that we integrate with, Datadog, but also Zapier APIs, like whatever it is you want to do. And you can automatically trigger incidents off the back of that. And you can sort of provide more extra, like more and extra context, like this service is affected, this particular piece of the product. And using our understanding of like, okay, well, if this part of the product is affected, I need to go and grab these people. We're sort of trying to offload what is extra work for you to do at a pretty stressful time.
Do you tie all those sources together? So, you know, if someone is the person who's assigned it in Jira, and they do the work in Git, and they're messaging in Slack, like, do you see a view that they're all the same person and not three different people?
Yes. So wherever possible, we tie everyone together, and that's sometimes a bit tricky. So, like, a good example is by default, Jira doesn't export from its API email addresses, and that's a common sort of thing that we'll do there. So we'll allow people to sort of like hook their accounts together. And then the other thing we do is like whenever we, so like incidents get quite messy and there's lots of things. There's GitHub PRs and there's, you say, Jira tickets and things. And we become like the hub where you can, the jump off point where you can go and find all those things, because it's just hard to go and scan a channel and go, what was the PR we shipped midway through that did this and that kind of thing. So it's essentially just like, I mean, it's like building this product is a little bit like building on easy mode, because we're all, the founding team, we're all engineers by trade, have lived and breathed these problems. And it's just sort of like, I remember when this was really hard and I used a Google spreadsheet for it. And, you know, it's just, fixing, making things ergonomic.
So going back to that a little bit, how did you come to this? Was it something internal to Workflow that you took out? Or was it something new? Or just a problem that you kept seeing there? Why start?
Yeah, I mean, do you want to tell them?
Yeah, I think so. Probably starts before Monzo. So I had started a startup beforehand. My other co-founder Pete had worked at a company called Go Cardless. So we were kind of independently arriving at the same conclusion of like, I get woken up by PagerDuty, and then there's sort of, it's then all on me. The software sort of stops at that point. And that feels kind of weird for something as important as, you know, a payments company that is like the base infrastructure for many companies above it.
I have used them, yeah.
and it's that sort of thing, like the amount of software and like development and product love that's gone into something so frequent, but like it just felt a bit like a white space. So kind of registered that in our minds as kind of a bit weird thing. Then went to Monzo. Chris had built like an amazing, I think, like first, first kind of inspiration for this product. And one of the most important things that I saw there was like, you know, in addition to it being like, I would have bought this with my personal credit card at my previous company. So like kind of works for me. It had organically got adoption through people outside of engineering within Monzo. So customer support agents, executives, risk and compliance. And to me, that was sort of the much kind of, that was, you know, kind of beautiful in that, you know, you start something, it's supposed to be intended for this use case, but turns out there's this like huge well of people that have been ignored and on the sidelines. And that, I think, the combination of, hey, we definitely need this thing at our old job. You know, this is a really great start. And we've seen all this like untapped potential that we had never even realized was like, okay, let's kind of go and see what would be out there. So we ended up, Chris and Monzo ended up open sourcing what was built in Monzo. We sort of built everything from scratch and have gone, I would say, like kind of far above and beyond what is there internally. And And yeah, but like formative experience, I think, in getting us to build this. But yeah, plenty of sort of new stuff on top.
How old is the company?
We have various founding dates. I would say when it went live to customers first, a little bit over 2 years.
Okay.
But it was like a side hustle for a bit, and then we joined the company.
So obviously everything is quite new.
Yeah.
What do you keep going to promote this together?
Good question. So we have literally just yesterday launched the status page products. This is something, one of like the most common integrations that people would bring with them is like, I need to communicate with my customers. We've got a new version of that. It's, it looks beautiful, but it like on top of that, it integrates really tightly into the response process. Like it's built into how we respond from Slack, which is just good. It means that like public comms are not a sort of afterthought that happen, you know, as a sort of side thing. They are very tightly integrated into how you deal with an incident, which means, you know, for companies these days, like you see it time and time again, right, where bad thing happens, people go to status page, it's all green and everything, you know, they're saying everything's up and it's just plainly not. And that's annoying and frustrating. And I think the more that you can do to get in front of that and be very public about using those comms, it worked incredibly well at Monzo. It's worked at other companies I've worked at, and we want to sort of promote that. So, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe the second reason as well is we, up until this point, have mostly grown through kind of people coming to us and asking for demos or trialing the product. We have really not kind of gone to see people and like shouted out and been loud about it. And this is the second conference that we've done and put sort of a bunch of effort into it. And yeah,
it's been a booth for a second conference.
Oh yeah, the team will be
fast learners.
Team will be very happy with that. I think we're like this year you'll see us kind of take the message to the world and go fly around, see potential customers and
spread the good word. 6 months time, 1 year time, depending if you go to KubeCon US or EU or whatever, what's next on the roadmap?
I'm trying to think what's good to share. What can I share? Essentially, without sort of going into any big gory details, like our sort of goal is to be a sort of one-stop shop for things going wrong at your organization. And so there's a bunch of sort of obvious adjacent product areas that we will move into. That will continue to be the case. Like essentially, we have a lot of signal from our customers of like the first thing they do when they come to us is bring tool X or tool Y. And so we're growing the engineering team, we're growing the go-to-market team. I expect that the product will just get more and more like broad and more powerful. And then there's honestly like a bunch of slightly left field things that we've seen. And so maybe an example, like risks are something which are very common and sort of very adjacent to incidents. And there's a very interesting angle here, which is like every company I've worked at in the past, like risk management was a case of like, well, we'll get the spreadsheet open and we'll do that once a quarter and we'll come up with some sort of like wild risks that everyone tries to like ideate on the spot. And really what you've got is like this whole corpus of data that's telling you where your risks are, and if you can start to tie incidents together through risks as this sort of like common join on those sorts of things, you now have empirical evidence of incidents that are happening, and where you're not having incidents, maybe the product helps you run game days to make sure that you're prepared for those risks that you've not yet seen.
So at HavingCube, we are building the central nervous system for our world. This means we're connecting physical and digital devices like cars, factories, and so on, and we are bringing that all together and have this kind of central nervous system. So in essence, we are an Internet of Things middleware company that is connecting millions of devices for most of our customers.
I know what you do. I'm just trying to weed out the explanation for someone who doesn't. What is that central nervous system? What is it doing between devices?
Yes.
What's happening?
Yes. So one of the key things we observed over the last few years, the technology built for the Internet of Humans, it's not a technology we can use for the Internet of Things. So if you think about that, we have now 8 billion people on Earth. But we have, depending on the analyst you ask, we have now approximately 40 billion devices connected to the Internet. So more than 5 devices per human being, accelerating really massively. And so what we are building is a so-called MQTT platform. And MQTT is a technology that connects devices, very constrained devices, like even small chips and so on, to the Internet in a very fast, reliable, and secure way that also saves a lot of traffic and bandwidth. And this is what we're focusing on. So our software resides in the cloud. Most of our customers run it in their own cloud or within our cloud. And they connect all the devices. And we have big automotive brands, most of the German car manufacturers are our customers, to a lot of big pharma companies connecting all the factories. And it's really like the use cases depend on the kind of customer and what we're doing. But what all have in common is they need to move the data where it needs to be.
Yeah.
And we're talking about millions of data points, sometimes per second, that need to be transmitted from edge to cloud or vice versa.
So, maybe this is my ignorance, but I feel like message queues have been around for a little while.
Yes.
Just for a little while, and sort of felt maybe, I don't know, like a thing that was kind of done, in quote marks. So
yes.
How long has 5MQ been around for, and what's the difference that you added to the existing?
And it's a great question, because, as I say, message queues have been around for a very long time. This is not something new. What's new is, though, how they're applied. Traditional message queues focus on reliability, but also at a very small scale. So if you think about IoT, you'd have millions of devices, you have millions of topics and subscriptions and so on. And traditional software like open source, like RabbitMQ, ActiveMQ and others, or commercial vendors like IBM MQ, Solace and others, they have some challenges when it comes to the cloud native world these days. And this is something we noticed when we founded the company in 2012. And what we've built is, we ask ourselves, how would a messaging infrastructure built for IoT, if you start with a blank slate, how would this look like? And so we're focusing on massive scalability, and the resource consumption is much better than with traditional messaging middleware. And we are achieving this with a focus. I sometimes tell it to people, like, I'm a big cook. I love cooking with my wife. And what we have is, you have this nice, beautiful chef's knife there. I would never, ever use a Swiss Army knife for cooking. But this is what people are using these days. Traditional message queues are Swiss Army knives. You can use it for a lot of things. But if you have a specific problem, like you want to cook a nice meal, they're not really good at that. A chef's knife is really built for that. And HiveMQ is purpose-built for IoT. And to also bring this into perspective, we have a customer that recently migrated away from a traditional messaging middleware to HiveMQ, and they had almost 10 times cost savings in infrastructure for the same use case, just because of the efficiency gains. And this is what we're focusing on. But besides the replacement, we're also focusing on a lot of new use cases you couldn't be doing with traditional messaging middleware.
So does this handle things like Apache connectivity and aspects like that that IoT will have at times where messages actually won't go through for a while?
So a key difference for IoT is messaging middleware traditionally focuses on the message itself only. What we have these days, we have more. We have also events. This is also where technologies like Apache Kafka really excel when you are in an event-driven world. And there's also messages. You have both here. And just for the difference for the audience, a message is usually something of value that can also be modified, while an event is just an observation that you're passing through. And with IoT, you have both. And also, what is different with IoT is you have this constant connectivity. And in technology speaking, a technology like MQTT is built for always-on connectivity, where you also have push communication down to the device. So an MQTT broker, it's not only a message broker, it's also a device management platform.
You mentioned the cloud aspect. I think you also said this, but I just want to clarify it. I'm guessing because the patchy connectivity, the privacy concerns, the various reasons for IoT, that you also offer the ability to not use the cloud and just communicate directly to devices. Yeah.
Yes. And I brought up the central nervous system before, and what this means for us is we have this, our architects call this a multi-tiered application. Let's think about a use case in manufacturing. You have multiple factories, and all of them have in common, they need to produce 24/7. You cannot have a single minute of downtime because it costs a lot of money. So most of the commerce choose to not have a direct cloud connectivity that needs to be online in order to have the factory function. You don't do that. So you have an autonomous, basic messaging infrastructure in the factory or in all the factories. but you also want to have a central view of data. This is where cloud comes in. So what you usually do is you have messaging infrastructure in factories and then a central one, and then you're connecting these. And so you're interconnecting that, you're filtering messages, you're passing along only the messages required where you want them to be. And the beauty of it is you have that from cloud back to the factory, but also from factory to cloud. So this is what we call bidirectional communication.
Yeah. For someone who's never not heard of or not used the concept before, what is the difference with just using a message queue and just, I don't know, using a standard way of just communicating between services, like making HTTP requests,
yeah,
like that? Like, what,
yeah,
why would you switch from one to the other?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, a very, very good question. So the old paradigm, how web technology is built, it makes a lot of sense for microservices and so on, also for backends. I mean, these days you see a lot of movement into event-driven architectures. Apache Kafka is used a lot these days there. But overall, this is, I think, a matter of taste and matter of use case also, because it works pretty well here. It's a well-understood problem. Once you get into IoT, you usually have the internet in between, and very often mobile internet, and very often also you have low bandwidth, high latencies, and so on. And this means you have a lot of traffic costs, because while I have a mobile plan, I have, I think, 20 gigabytes of traffic for free with a mobile plan. If you are have device mobile plans, it costs a lot of money. This is a major cost driver. And the other thing is you want a great user experience. Customers expect snappy responses all the time, because we are spoiled with instant messaging and so on. And so we actually need a way to instant message also devices. And with HTTP, you don't have that. And of course, people are saying, oh, you can use WebSockets and so on. But good luck scaling that to whatever, 20 million devices. And so with MQTT as a technology and, for example, HyphenQ as an MQTT platform providing the implementation, you get all of that. An open standard that is built for low data transmission, snappy responses. We're talking about sub 100 milliseconds, sometimes with 5G even sub 10 milliseconds of data transmission and massive scale. Like connecting millions of devices to a single server, and then also exchanging hundreds of thousands of messages per second.
And what are you here at KubeConf to talk about, to promote? Yeah,
I mean, KubeCon is great so far. We have some awesome conversations. So we talk to a lot of architects because in most industries, there's a shift now how you do software architectures. And most industries have an IoT use case. This means because they're adding additional services, additional monetization layers for what they're selling. And sometimes they're just asked to reduce costs. And we have a lot of conversations there of replacing the old way of doing things when it comes to IoT. And also just, okay, how you do messaging in 2023. And yeah, we have some great conversations so far. Let's see how it is. It's just day one in KubeCon now,
yeah,
not today. But great conversations. And most of our customers are Fortune 500 customers.
Yeah.
And small and also consulting companies that are really trying to figure out how to do software architecture in 2023. And we're helping with that.
Yeah. What have you seen or do you see on the schedule interests you, that excites you about this place?
Yeah. There's a lot of things that is exciting to me. One of the things I really enjoy seeing, that it seems like we're moving now from, okay, how to do Kubernetes and how to orchestrate workloads. Now, okay, how do we govern actually the workloads?
Yeah.
How are we governing also the data there? It's also a major topic we're working on with the customers. How do you govern also the data streams? And it's great to see on the one side, on the infrastructure level, what we see here, and we're also adding that on the device layer and on the data layer. And we have some great conversations there also. And also our own cloud, it's built on cloud native technologies.
Yeah.
So we're also users on one side, and we're also contributors to the whole ecosystem.
6 months time at KubeCon US or a year's time for KubeCon EU. What do you think, what's going to be new for you in the next few months? What are you working on?
Oh, we have some.
That you can talk about.
Yeah, we have some big launches coming up. So next month we're about to launch a pure platform as a service.
Peer to peer.
A platform as a service layer for MQT connectivity. So for now, we have a serverless cloud that has great adoption. And next month, we are about to release. By the way, the serverless cloud is completely free for most use cases. It's very easy to get started. And next month, we are launching a pure platform as a service play on all the major clouds for device connectivity across all the different cloud vendors, which I think will be pretty huge, what we've seen so far with the early customers on that. And we're also, in the next few months, we will talk about the next KubeCon, about something very exciting for the Edge. Edge is a huge topic for KubeCon here. And I can't talk too much about it, but this will be majorly exciting, especially for manufacturing customers.
And I'm back. Did you miss me from the show floor? Always a bit noisy. Did my best to clean things up. I'm going to keep my outro quite brief because you've heard probably quite enough already on this episode. And I'll be back next week with a more normal show. Actually got quite a lot of other news I want to catch you up with. But that was KubeCon EU 2023. It's great to be back. Great to be back at parties. Last year was also kind of same, but a little restricted. And this year back very much to normal. Good to be back. Good to see that despite various things happening in the industry, still pretty busy, still pretty lively, still lots going on. I had a good time. Many parties I attempted to get into, generally failed. And if you want to find out more about me, you can do that wherever you found this podcast or christianscheller.com. And I'll be back next episode with a more normal show. Thank you very much for joining me and take care. I hope you enjoyed the show. Find out more about me at christianscheller.com, where you can find show notes, sign up for my newsletter, and find all of my writing, games, work, and video links. There's also details on how to get in touch with me. And if you want to get even closer to what I do, join my Discord server for behind-the-scenes discussions and helping me produce my shows and work.